So if a deal is going to go awry, it's usually going to happen at the closing table. So the seller might be unsure of what to look for on the HUD. Most of my sellers, okay, they go to closing and they're just going there with a pen and a smile is what I tell them to do, and just sign, you know, just sign, and they're going to get the money, and you're going to show them, okay, this is important too. Make sure that when you use when you go to your contract with your seller, make sure it's a net contract, okay? And what that means is if you say you're going to give them $42,000, that's what they're going to walk away with at closing without having to worry about, you know, transfer tax and grantor's fees and all these different things, unless they have some obscene judgments or liens or things that they need to pay. They're going to be walking away with a check for $42,000. So all they have to do is look at that line on the HUD where it shows cash to seller, and they see that $42,000, and everything else really doesn't mean, you know, doesn't really mean anything to them. So this is what you want to do. I really don't go to closing at all anymore. But what I'll do is I'll go over the HUD with them at night because, or the day before the closing, because I have my closing attorney email me the HUD so I can review it, and I definitely recommend that you do that as well, so that way when closing is about to happen, you don't have problems going and the seller gets uncomfortable for whatever reason may be. So make sure your HUD is straight the day before. Contact the seller and say, all right, I just want to go over with you exactly what's going on at the closing, all right? You're going to be cutting $42,000 at closing, and all you need to do is you're going to need to sign your name there, and we will have completed this deal, and everything will work out. So that's the way you prep the HUD. You make sure the seller understands exactly what's going on, and this is what you do to point out on the HUD. Make sure the HUD is laid out correctly by the closing attorney, okay? This is something I see that attorneys actually do, and I don't know if it's because they don't understand or if it's actually the way it's supposed to go. You know, most of the time, the HUD, the assignment fee goes in the line, the 1,300 line items. Isn't that right, JP?
Yes. Yep.
So, which is the miscellaneous miscellaneous items that are going on the HUD. But make sure, sometimes what happens is the attorney or closing attorney or title company will put your HUD right next to the purchase price. I mean, put your assignment fee, rather, right by the purchase price. Or they'll even make your HUD, let's say I'm buying for 42 and I'm selling for 47. They'll actually put the contract purchase price as 47. You don't want to do that. You got to tell them, no, the contract price is 42,000 and my assignment fee is 5,000. So sometimes what you have to do to come to a happy medium for whatever reason, if they don't want to put that in line item 1304 or in the 1300 section, they'll actually put your assignment fee right underneath the purchase price. And I'm okay with that sometimes, because sometimes I'll use my buyer's closing attorney who may not, you know, understand exactly where everything's supposed to go, and I just walk them through it. So prepping the HUD actually has to do with prepping the attorney and the seller and making sure everybody's on the same page. So again, the main thing is show the seller what they're going to be walking away with from the closing table, and you're going to be avoiding a lot of problems down the road.
Alex, what do you like to have the closing company call it when they list it as a line item? You know, what they call it can matter. What terminology
they
do you
actually
like
call
to
it an assignment? They call it an assignment fee.
Okay. You touched on the word partner earlier. I like to have them put partner split, which
really
kinda
lends, that's a good idea.
Yeah, it kind of leans towards what you said earlier. Now, some people may feel uneasy about calling your end buyer your partner. And let me just say, you really need to get over that. Partner is actually what he is. Now, it is a joint venture partner on a deal basis, right? So it doesn't mean that you have a legal partnership with this person that, you know, you file it with the state and that kind of stuff. It's not that type of partnership, but it is a joint venture partnership. So there is absolutely no problem. In fact, when I'm talking to, when I'm negotiating with a seller, I'll tell them, you know, as part of my my contingencies, my contractor is going to have to look at this and my partners are going to have to look at it. They have to lay eyes on it to make sure it works for them. It works for me. I'm pretty sure it'll work for them, but I got to have them lay eyes on it. And when I say partners, who do you think I'm talking about? I'm talking about all of my potential partners in this deal, one of whom will be buying it.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
don't be afraid
to
use that terminology.
Funding partner is a really good way to put it.
Yeah, and that is not a term that scares or intimidates people. It makes total sense, and it gives them a good sense of, okay, well, that makes sense. I can understand why you need to do that. And when they see it, you know, on the HUD, it makes logical sense. It's not that you're trying to hide something from them, that you're in business to make money or anything, but they already are coming into this transaction potentially a little leery of you. You know, investors
of course
don't necessarily have a reputation like realtors do, because we don't have a bunch of lobbyists and millions of dollars of ad campaigns making us look like the greatest thing since sliced bread. In fact, there's always that history of negative press that the one bad apple gives all the rest of us. So they're already approaching it from kind of a sideways look. Hopefully, you're good at building rapport with them so that they don't have the reason to feel that way. But there's always that underlying, I'm waiting for you to give me a reason to distrust you. So you don't want to give them information that they won't understand, that will confuse them at best, or give them a reason to be afraid of you. So it's not that you're trying to deceive them in some way by not just saying, well, I'm an assignment fee, I'm a wholesaler, I'm going to flip this to somebody. They will automatically, they just don't understand it. It feels like, you know, anytime a confused mind says no, you guys have heard that, a confused mind says no. So
that's
frame
right.
Everything you do from a way that they will not be confused by it.
And no,
I'm sorry, to another point you said earlier about having your title company send you the HUD 1 in advance, I'm going to tell you absolutely positively do that. And if your title company, if your closing attorney gives you any flack because they don't want to send that to you a day in advance, find another title company to work with. You absolutely
right.
have a right to see it. They should be responsible enough to have it prepared in time. And I can tell you there are mistakes on the HUD that you will need to fix from time to time. It will happen.
More often than not.
So you need – that's it's if you're not familiar with the HUD, it can be an intimidating-looking document. Okay? I know that. But once – it's like anything. Once you get into it and you have somebody explain it to you one time, it just clicks and you go, okay, this is really not nearly as awful and confusing as I thought it was going to be. That's one document you really need to understand how it works, and so that when they send it to you, you can look at it and make sure that everything looks like it's in its proper place. And you may have to call them and say, no, you guys, you got to fix this. You know, I'm supposed to be making $8,000, not $5,000 on this, and also you can't call it this because I don't want you to call it that. So that's
right.
The kind of relationship you need to have with them, no ifs, ands, or buts. And you can easily frame it well when you're going over it in advance with your seller, like you suggested, Alex. Easy just to say, this is an intimidating document. Things are going to go kind of fast at closing tomorrow, and I don't want you to be confused by it. So that's why I want to go through it with you in advance, and they appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, what you're really doing is overcoming or addressing a problem before it becomes a problem, you know?
Yeah.
You're taking care of and also by going over it yourself more and more, you'll gain more experience with it. But let me also say this. The HUD is a document that can that can actually keep you out of jail or land you in jail. So make sure you understand it very, very well. I don't
yeah.
want to scare anybody, but make sure that everything you do at closing is on the HUD.
Yep. Yep. Don't say, I'll just take my assignment fee off of the HUD.
No.
Even if people tell you that you can do that.
Especially if there's a bank involved.
Oh, yeah. Especially now more than ever, that's true.
For sure. For sure. Okay, so we're ready to move on to the next one?
Yep.
Okay, the competition crusher trick, okay? Now this is something that I've used and has bit me in the past because I did it wrong, and this is something I've used that's worked really well, okay? So a lot of sellers are going to call multiple investors. It's just going to happen just from, just like I said, the mentality of going on Google and filling out every single seller form that you can lay your hands on. But sometimes you don't want to be the first one out there every single time, because this, with this, you could come in after the other investor and find out what they offered and beat it. You know, and this can happen to you too. But what this is going to help is bringing that seller to reality. Okay, if you're the one that has to deliver the bad news, sometimes you don't get the deal just because of the nature of your news. You know, you could call. Basically, what you do is, you know, you find out a very simple question: am I the only one that you're dealing with here on this house? And they'll tell you, oh, you're the first one of many, or they'll say, yeah, we're, you know, you're the only one you're dealing with. And usually that happens when you do direct mail. Sometimes, for whatever reason, you're the only one they deal with when you go with direct mail. The internet can sometimes just lead to a shopper's mentality. But when you're dealing with the sellers along this line, you want to make sure that you're the last one in the door. And sometimes this can be something to where if you are the last one and you have somebody that's a really good closer, they can, you know, they can cut you out and just shut it down right there. But if you're the last one in the door, okay, or let's say, let me put it this way. If you're the first one in the door and you know everybody else and their mom is going to be coming out there, what you say to the seller is, listen, I understand you want to get the most possible that you can get for this property, but if you will do me this favor, I'm going to help you get the most possible for your property, but please promise me that you will give me the last attempt on this property. So, therefore, now you're in a position to where you're helping the seller, okay, and you're in a position to where you're putting yourself to where you're not going to be in a bidding war because you're going to understand what that last offer is and you'll have a chance to attempt to beat it. So this is something to where you want to put yourself in a position where you're there to help the seller, but also they're going to be working with you. So it kind of builds a little rapport with them, but also helps you not waste your time either, because they, when they simply call and tell you what the highest offer is, you say, well, no, good luck. You better take that offer while it's still hot and save you a little bit of time and effort. So kind of a quick one. Do you have anything to say about that one?
So, I mean, just to make sure I'm understanding you, are you saying basically if you're going to, you're basically telling them if you're going to shop this to other people, before I put any more time into this, at least give me a last right of refusal kind of thing.
Exactly. That's exactly what you do. And it's just a matter of asking. You know, some people right away when they get into that situation, they just – and I have the temptation to do this as well. I'm like, oh, they're just shopping. I'm out of here. You know, I'm never going to get a good deal on this property. So instead of doing that and putting yourself in a chance to a spot to succeed – you simply ask them that simple question. And I actually heard this, I got that sort of from Than Merrill. You know, when people are shopping, you put yourself in that spot where you have the last refusal because you're positioning it to the standpoint of you're going to try to get them the most for their house, but also you got to work with me in order for me to do that. So
I like that.
All right. So the next trick is the expired wholesaler trick. This one. It's
is that dead
like
wholesalers? Is that what that is?
Dead wholesalers. Now, this basically is a trick that is kind of like expired listings on the MLS. But what it does is puts you in the position to profit, again, from other people's efforts, marketing money, time spent, and everything. So the expired wholesaler trick. A lot of investors out there, you know, are putting properties under contract and they're not selling them. Why? Well, mainly they're not using the shop and drop trick. They haven't been on this call. No, just kidding.
Right.
but they're not at the right price point. People are just think that they can go out there, put a property under contract, and some people do this. Some investors, you know, they go see a property that's listed from you know, in the newspaper or whatever, and they get all excited. They call the seller up and they offer them a price, and now they have a property under contract. They go out there and they sign it, and they're all excited. But then they get crash into the depths of despair when they can't sell it because they don't have it at the right price point. And that's what a lot of wholesalers are doing out there right now, because they're not properly educated on knowing where the right values are. And remember, another way you can learn where those right values are is the rapid REO evaluation trick. So check what the REOs are doing and see what's going on and make sure you're at the right price point to avoid being the expired wholesaler. So this is the truth. Sellers do not live in true reality when it comes to the price point, okay? Every seller thinks they can get the most they possibly can for the property, and they think it's just going to happen magically. But if you use other investors' inability to sell the property, you're using it to your advantage, okay? Let the other wholesaler go out there and offer too much and put it under contract, and this is what's going to happen. See, the seller is going to need – sometimes every seller needs that feeling of not being able to sell a property before they come to reality, okay? Some sellers are in the position to where – they think they don't understand the market. They think we're in the market of 4 to 5 years ago, where you would think about selling a house. And just as you're about to put that sign in the ground, somebody comes running out and says, no, no, wait, I'll buy it. It doesn't happen anymore. So sellers need to feel that they have that position to where, oh, man, I can't sell this property as easily as I thought. So wholesalers who are trying to get deals just to get deals, as a result, they can't move them. And a wholesaler who just wants that deal to get a deal gets the property at a price where you need to sell it and make money. They're right at that price point. So they're not maybe just too far off from where we need to be, but they've got it at the point to where where you need to buy it, or a rehabber needs to buy it, or whatever the case may be. So let's put this in the terms of real numbers. So let's say you need to get a property for $65,000. The wholesaler has it under contract for $65,000, and they can't sell it. Or I should say, you need to get it for $60,000 so you can make $65,000, but the wholesaler has it at $65,000. The seller is going to be a lot more apt, okay, to sell that property with the idea of a quick close, okay? So if you keep your eyes on the properties that are out there and are not selling. Now, I'm not saying they're going to be I'm not saying they're all properties out there are right on the verge of this, but if you keep yourself in tune to the other wholesalers' lists, you know, buyers be on their buyers list and things like that, and see what's going on, and keep your and keep attuned to it, you're going to run into this quite often. And the way to do this is you got to get on as many wholesalers lists as possible. Use the internet, use RIA meetings, and then watch the properties that come through and the price points that they're coming at. And then watch to see if they're selling their properties. You can do this by a follow-up phone call. You can call the wholesaler and ask them. A sneaky method of doing this is to check the public records and see if that property has changed hands yet. And then make an effort. You can make an effort to contact that seller directly by mailing the properties that have not sold, or you could call them if somehow you can, you know, get their phone number from, you know, from offline or something like that. But by putting them into a mailing sequence, you might be able, you can stumble upon some deals this way. So it's pretty much the same as using the expired listings on the MLS, but you're leveraging, again, the other wholesaler's properties, his marketing money and his time and things like that, and you're getting people where they're right at that last that point to where they now understand, yeah, I'm going to need to discount this property to get it sold. And if I just come down just a little bit more, maybe $5,000, maybe $7,000, I can get it, I can move it. Well, now we're in a spot to where we can profit from it. So by using this trick, again, all these little tips and techniques that I'm giving you, if you employ each one of them, you're definitely going to rustle you up some extra deals and things. So any comments on that one, JP?
Nope, nothing specifically on that one. Another good one, though.
Okay, spy on those that buy. This is a trick that is going to show you where the buyers are, okay? And that's what people have the question, where are the buyers? Well, you can try to use other wholesalers' buyers, like I was saying, but it's always good to make data-driven decisions. And most wholesalers are banging their heads against the wall looking for buyers. You're going to, you know, and if you waste your time working with unqualified and unproven buyers, you're going to bang your head against the wall too. Not everybody who says, oh, yeah, I want to buy your property and doesn't even give you a hesitation on the price or whatever is the person you want to deal with, because they might be trying to tie up your property to try to wholesale it to somebody else, or they may think they've got the money and they can't qualify or whatever the reason may be. So make sure you're dealing with people that are actually doing in the market. So the key is to find the buyers that are actually buying properties today, not years ago. These are the buyers that are going to write your paycheck, basically, because you will know the exact areas they are buying in and what prices they are buying at, okay? So this is a trick that's going to show you not only who's buying, but where they're buying, even down to the subdivisions they're buying in. Okay, the step to implement this, okay, and I got this from Chris Chico.
Let me say this before you go into this, Alex, guys.
Yes.
If you're distracted right now, stop it. Pay close attention to what you're about to learn. We've covered lots of great tactics. This is probably one of the biggest, sweetest, most important so far. So pay attention. That's all. That is all.
Wake up. Okay. So go to listsource.com, www.listsource.com, and again, I can't manage the screen right now to show you exactly what you need to do, but you select the absentee homeowners, you can select the criteria by city or county, and then you select your state and your county or city, and then you are going to look for the last market recording date within the last 3 to 6 months, okay? And these are – now, I guess what I should do is define absentee for people who don't know. What that means is people – who have properties that that they don't live at. They're investment properties. They could be properties that are rentals, or they could be properties that they just bought to flip or whatever the case may be. And this is targeted by the tax assessment or tax bill being sent to a different mailing address than what the actual property address is, okay? So that's what how this finds those type of people, okay? So you're gonna purchase a spreadsheet and sort for repeat buyers and what they are buying. And this is as cheap as 10 to 12 cents a name, okay? So if you do this, you can do this like after this call is over, and you can literally find 200 real buyers within the last 3 to 6 months who are actually buying in this market, and then you can check to see who's the repeat buyers. You can even get a little fun with this and even go 3 years back and spend a little bit of money, you know, and you can see who's really been buying throughout the down markets and the high markets and the low markets and where they're buying. But there's one thing here that you have to see that is important, okay? Just because somebody has recently bought doesn't necessarily mean they're a good buyer. They could have just been the one-time buyer, the one-time, oh, I'm going to give real estate a shot. I got all excited because I saw flip this house and flip that house and Property Ladder and Property Virgins and all this stuff, and now they're going to go out and try to attempt it themselves. And they might be on that one property that's going to sink them because they don't understand how to do a rehab or whatever. You know, they may not necessarily be a good buyer, but the good buyers are the repeat buyers who have been buying over and over and over again. And now you can spy on that because you have the data. You can see where they're buying, how they're buying, and what they're buying for. So this is key and critical information when you're looking to move your deals for sure.
And if you really get aggressive, if you want to get really aggressive with it, you can do a reverse lookup on some of your hottest prospects there. You can just Google reverse lookup, and you'll get a bunch of ways that you can do that. It's not free, but it's not that expensive either. And you, a lot of times you can track down a phone number for those people and actually call them up, not just send them a letter, but call them up and say, hey, are you buying houses in this area? Because I got a house I'm trying to sell. You'll get their attention if they're buyers.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. That's definitely one way to do it. You could call it. call them, or you could even mail them. And that's, you know, that's the Chico tactic, is to send them a direct mail piece, send them to a blog to capture their information and go that way. That's a little advanced way of doing things. But the main key is you've got their information right there in front of you, and you can mail them or call them or do whatever you want, and try to get them on your team, so to speak.
Alex,
okay, this next
quick question. Do you know, just because I don't, for curiosity's sake, where ListSource gets their data from?
Yes, they get it from First American CoreLogic, and they are tied in sisters with RealQuest.com. So RealQuest.com is a subscription website, and ListSource is not. So you can sign up for ListSource and just buy a one-time list, or you can sign up with RealQuest. I actually am a subscriber with RealQuest, and I can download up to 5,000 records per county and get comps with my subscription. So that's www.realquest.com, 5,000 records per county, so that way I'm not, you know, buying 10 cents a name every single time. And it's really more economical for me as a full-timer. So
what does ListSource cost you for your subscription?
I pay $350 a month for 6 counties. And again, I can download up to 30,000 records a month if I wanted to for that price.
Nice. And it's the same data, basically, though.
It's the same exact data, just a different portal, so to speak.
Okay.
Makes sense. That's the way to go. And you can get comps with RealQuest, too. So
how do you feel about the quality of the comps? I've only used comps from the MLS or from a local service here called Chandler. So I'm not familiar with the quality of their comps. I know you don't want to use things like, you know, Zillow comps are a joke. So how does this
you know, actually, you know, you say that, but I actually use Zillow Cyber Homes as points of reference when I'm considering the comps from RealQuest to the MLS. I look at everything, okay? But I think RealQuest is really good on comps because it's straight out of the courthouse. That's where that data comes. So you can actually narrow it down to subdivision if you want in with RealQuest, or you can do a mile radius. And it actually will give you the FSBO, or for sale by owner sales, that the MLS does not pick up.
And that is a benefit, definitely.
So that's, you know, it's definitely advantageous to have all that there. But Zillow and CyberHomes, out of those, I think CyberHomes is more accurate. It usually has a lower, more conservative value for what that's worth.
Okay.
It's getting better and better for some reason. I think maybe because more data is coming through. I don't know where they pull their data from, but I think there's more readily data available on the internet. Or maybe it's just the low REO sales that are going through that is neutralizing the high prices that it used to have.
Maybe so. And I haven't given those things a try in a while. So, you know, the last
time I tried
them.
Well, you got the MLS. You don't need it.
Right. They were kind of new when I first started playing with them, and I would compare that to what I was seeing in the MLS. And it was probably just because they didn't have enough data to really balance everything out. But I guess it would make sense the more the more the data they get. Of course, Google is assisting with that in so many ways, but they're gonna get more accurate. So that makes sense.
No, seriously, definitely. Okay, the next trick is the ghost offer trick. many beginning investors are afraid to make offers to sellers, okay? And frankly, I don't like making offers to sellers personally myself. It's just you always get that knot in your stomach, and you always get that feeling of uncomfortability. Is that a word? I don't know. But that feeling of uneasiness. Yeah, the feeling of uneasiness. And many investors quit because they can't handle that negative reaction or criticism. And if you're on this call, I'm sure you've heard the call that I was on, the bad call, right, where that seller was was letting me know what he thought. and that's what – it's the truth. It's what happens. This is what I do, okay? I have virtual assistants, one in particular, that makes offers for me. Now, here's another way you can use the ghost offer trick. You could send them a fax of your offer if they have a fax, or you could send them an email or whatever the case may be. That way you don't have to deal with the negative response and you only get to deal with the deals. I think the virtual assistant method is better because you're actually having the VA talk to somebody and actually kind of shielding you from that negative reaction. Because when you fax, they're going to want to call you up and say, what? What are you, blah, 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 and go all if it's really that type of a seller. So I only have VA make an offer after I tell them exactly what to say and offer, and that's something I recommend that you guys do to start out with. But I'm actually in the process of systematizing my business a little bit more because I find that I spend a lot of time going through each one of my leads and say, okay, offer this, offer that, offer that, offer that. I'm just going to come up with a rough formula that's not too low, but that's in a position to where if they're willing to play ball, it'll give me, you know, I'll focus my attention a lot more on it rather than having to deal with all, you know, all the people that I really wouldn't do business with anyway. And it stops me from having to make, you know, to send all the emails that I do to my virtual assistant on a daily basis for what to offer and what to say and things like that. So that's just me trying to streamline what I got going on.